The Hunting Collective is presented by Element.
I guess I grew up on an older road.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Hunting Collective. I am Ben O'Brien. What is this, episode 154, Phil?
Hey, you got it. Great.
Ah, look at me. Look at me. How you doing over there, buddy?
I'm doing all right. I was just telling you, I'm going to the chiropractor for the first time today. I've been in great pain since I woke up Friday morning. I have we've all had those nights where we sleep funny. We wake up the next day a little stiff. Normally for me though, it eventually works its way out after a couple hours of me just taking it easy. This has only gotten worse. I hadn't been able to turn my head, in any meaningful way for several days.
Let me see, try to turn your head. How far can you turn your head? Let me see.
Well, so swiveling is actually not too bad.
Like, yeah, that looks all right. Oh, that's it?
Like tilting. I can't tilt at all.
Yeah. Phil tilted his head about 1 degree.
Yes.
Visible pain. All right. Well, everybody send Phil get well soon messages on Instagram.
Just send nice thoughts.
Should we give out your address? Maybe people send you care packages, White Claw, maybe something like that for the holidays.
Yeah, I'll tack that on to the end of the show. I'll definitely do that.
All right, perfect. All right, well, a lot to get to today. We got Mark Kenyon, the great and powerful Mark Kenyon, from Wired to Hunt, from Back 40, and all the different things that you know from the Meat Eater Whitetail content that he leads over here. We're going to talk about a lot of things, specifically hunting with your dad, and also the psychology of naming deer and then chasing the deer you named all year long, having like some weird relationship with the particular single deer, which Mark tends to do. So we're going to get to that a little bit later in the show with Mr. Kenyon. But before we get to that, we got to talk about our Thanksgiving. My Thanksgiving was made better by all of you because we ask for Thanksgiving holiday traditions and you all absolutely came through. I was laughing pretty much the entire holiday weekend and also moved by a lot of the stuff that you guys sent in. But I will say this. Let me just say that part of why I wanted to have this contest, one, I'm a silly little bitch and I like to make jokes, and Phil just shook his head like, yeah, you are. I like to have fun. And I like to do things that are sarcastic and ironic, and that's just me. But also, you know, 2020 has been a tough year for a lot of people. It's a year where a lot of the normalcy that we're used to, the things that kind of track our lives and keep us sane, have been ripped away from us. So it's nice to, especially around these holiday seasons when we might not have been able to gather like we all wanted to, it's nice to remember the things that keep us going and to look back in order to look forward. So that really came through in spades with everybody sending their stuff in. Now, Phil, this was my first, I'll be 35 on Wednesday, tomorrow. This is the first time in my 35 years that I didn't have Thanksgiving with my family. What about you? What's the Thanksgiving feel around the T engineer household?
Honestly, this was exactly, we had the same Thanksgiving that we always do ever since I, moved away from home, came out to Montana for school, met my wife. We've always just done Thanksgiving as the two of us. And then with some little kid additions along the way. And we usually save the family gathering for Christmas. Just 'cause we don't live anywhere near family. We haven't for a while now. So, for budgetary reasons and just like wrangling children reasons, we just stick the family gathering on Christmas, and we usually have a small Thanksgiving. So this Thanksgiving wasn't a whole lot different for me.
Yeah, for me, it was, I've always, you know, my brother and I, so my family, I have a brother, so it's just me and my brother. We're around the same age. So like, we've always kind of coalesced around Thanksgiving. I mean, we both lived around home until college time. He moved to Georgia for college. I've moved around the country pretty consistently for the last 12 years or so, and so has he. But somehow we've always managed to get on the plane, get on the train, get on the bus, get in the car, and find our way back home for Thanksgiving. it's always a priority. And to your point, Phil, I always spend way more money than I can afford and spend a lot more time now that I have kids being miserable during Thanksgiving to get them to the place.
Man, traveling with kids is no joke.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter whether you do plane or car or train. There's so much baggage, literal and figurative, that comes with traveling with kids. It's a whole new ball game.
I always feel like it's the Oregon Trail, Oregon Trail. You're like, yeah, man, you pack up the wagon. We're going east.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that's my experience. My dad brought this up to me the other day. My brother did as well. Like, hey, man, this is the first time that we haven't been together with your mom and eventually significant others and eventually kids. This is the first time we haven't ever done that in our entire lives. And so this, you know, the positive was we didn't have to travel. We didn't have to go through all the craziness we normally do as a family to get home. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was a tough couple of days just knowing, this is the first time that we weren't together. So I'm sure there, you know, a lot of you listening have similar stories. Maybe you're like, Phil, it just was another Thanksgiving, but I tend to think that a lot of people's lives are in some form of upheaval, and so was your holiday. So it's good to look at traditions and kind of ground ourselves. Now, and I didn't mean for the contest that we announced last week to be like a real sappy affair, but man, it was, and I think maybe that you know tells me where everybody's heads are at right now in terms of the holiday season. So we're going to read some emails. We're going to get to some of the entries and some of the stories that people sent in for their holiday traditions. But to remind everyone, the long story of how this contest came to be, Phil and I spent months planning this out. Essentially, what we asked people to do last week on last week's show was to send us some sort of video, photo, story, anything that would tell their holiday tradition, that would tell us about what they did. And we wanted to be entertained, and in return, you would get some Element, some Drink Element tea. Of course, always go to drinkelementtea.com/meateater, support Drink Element, our title sponsor. We'd get you a bunch of Element to get you hydrated, salty hydration. We're going to get you that, and then we're going to get you a Yeti tumbler emblazoned with the Hunting Collective logo on it. Only available here at my house to send to you. And then, most importantly, especially Phil was adamant that we include this. He told me, he said, hey, this is a great idea. That I only now follow White Claw on my Instagram, my social media. I watched The Social Dilemma, the documentary. I got a little bit scared. And then next thing I know, I'm up in the middle of the night deleting everybody from my Instagram. So now, but then I got to White Claw and I just couldn't hit that unfollow button. And so now they're the only people I follow. And they don't have their social media kind of sucks anyway. It's just pictures of cans of White Claw.
They could really use to step up their game over there.
Yeah. I mean, if they would bring us on if they would sponsor us, we would do free social content for them, free videos, free everything. I mean, but they just won't return our calls, unfortunately. So anyway, that's what we were doing. A lot of you sent things in. A lot of them made me laugh, but the bulk of them were moving and something. I actually read a couple of these and got a little emotional myself, Phil, which I was not expecting to do. So I'm going to read a few of these. But first of all, Phil, did you see the THC pie?
I did. They were very, very impressive.
Impressive.
Yeah, I loved it.
This was Katrina. She's at Kit Kat is Hungry. I think that's what that says. Kit Kat is Hungry. She said, happy Turkey Day, Ben. Every year I make a pie. And this year was no exception, except that I tried to write THC with the crust. And now my family just thinks I'm some kind of pothead. Parentheses, they aren't wrong, but still not what I wanted to discuss via Zoom. And it's a nice looking pie. You can clearly see the THC on the pie, so I appreciate that there is now a THC pie. So thank you, Katrina, for helping us out there. I will also say that the cult debate rages on, Phil. I mean, rages on.
in my life.
Does it though? I feel like it's about 90% of people telling you it's a horrible idea.
No, that's not. It's not. It's 50-50.
No,
it's
a that's I not look. True.
I did a tab. I tabulated this shit.
Okay.
It's 50-50. The people that, you know, it's one of those things where the people that hate it think it's the worst thing in the world. The people that love it are embracing it with all of their being. So, you know how I like a, you know, a good polarizing topic. So, you know, we'll keep it going. A lot of people are signing their emails, cult follower, all kinds of things. So here we go. But anyway, we got a lot to get to today, but what I'm going to do now is just read some emails from all of you that share any traditions. A couple of them really made me stop and be like, wow, this is a cool damn show that we do. So I just wanted to preempt this by saying, like, when I was looking at this morning, I thought I'd spend about half an hour skimming through some stuff, pick out the good ones. I spent about 3 hours reading it, all these emails, looking at all these photos, laughing. But like, overall, the feeling was real heartwarming. So thank you, everybody. First one comes from Austin Smith. Really appreciate your name, Austin. It's really easy to pronounce. He said he sent a couple of pictures along. He said, my name is Austin, and I wanted to tell y'all what this holiday weekend has meant to me. I snapped this picture. He sent a cool little picture of a bunch of his family around a table. He said, I snapped this picture over the holiday without telling anyone. Also, looking back at it, I'm tearing up because this isn't my holiday tradition. My family has been splitting apart in some ways recently, and to be honest, we didn't have this type of holiday growing up anyway because my dad was Air Force and we never lived close to family and never had any traditions aside from food. This year, my brother's in-laws invited us up to their place on the Rocky Mountain front outside of Augusta, Montana. Most of my family went. This is a raw picture of their family mixed with my family. A group of people wildly different, some hunters, some brainiacs, a nurse, a stay-at-home mom, young newlyweds, and some older people that have lost their spouse. But all of us in a different stage in life, coming together to enjoy fellowship, food, hunting, stories, laughs, and excitement makes the reality of life feel easier and more of a blessing when surrounded by those that we love. I've never felt so included by and thankful for people that I've known for such a short period of time. I hope this doesn't seem long-winded or too much or too sappy, but it's all true. And when I was trying to figure out how to enter this contest last week while listening to the podcast, I kept coming up empty because of the lack of traditions my family has. I wish this is how it had always been, but I can pray this is how it'll always continue to be. A weekend of love, laughter, and hunting. Also, a time to brag and show some firsts. He sent a picture of his younger brother with his first deer over the weekend, and he got his first earlier in the season. Pretty badass. Thank you, Austin Smith. I'm glad you got to hang out with your family, dude. It looks pretty fun. The photo, I don't know if you guys are drinking or not, but it looks like you're having a good time nonetheless. Anyway, Phil, these are all pretty heartwarming, man. Did you feel warm by that email?
Yeah, no, I can kind of, I'm in kind of the same boat as Austin, because whenever I think about traditions, I don't, like, the first thing that runs through my head is that I don't really have any. Or at least growing up, I was like, there wasn't a specific thing we did, like, surrounding an event, like hunting or going somewhere specific. There are these like little tiny things that are tied to the holidays. Like, for example, we would always just visit my dad's parents on Christmas Eve and my mom's parents on Christmas. And that doesn't sound like there's not really anything exciting about that, but I'm still very much tied to that ritual. And I have really fond and warm memories around those two dates. And it doesn't have to be anything big. It doesn't have to be something momentous. It's those small details that remind me how important family is, even if at the time it didn't seem like it. Looking back, it definitely had an impact on me.
Yeah, I mean, for those of us that like had a good family unit growing up, whether that's just your extended family or just, you know, your parents and siblings, when you move away like I did or Phil did, you certainly get some perspective on what was just normal life growing up. You know, for me, it was very much when I was a kid, it was, we would wake up, we would hang out, we would get ready, we would go to my first grandmother's house, who was like the best cook in the world. She was this short lady and like the most homey little house on View Street in Hagerstown, Maryland. Like, we would go there and it would be the warmest place. We would have a wonderful meal with our family. And it was a very wholesome event. Like, I think about that time, and I think about like the warmth of that side of my family. It's my dad's side of the family. And then we would go to my mom's side of the family next for like a second meal. Now there, the food wasn't as good. In fact, I told this story at my grandmother's funeral. She used to make, I think it was sweet potato casserole or some sort of sweet potatoes. She was not a good cook. And it would be like black on the top. And then you would put a spoon in that shit and it would be nuclear orange underneath the black burnt casserole. And she did this fairly often during my childhood, as if it was a traditional dish. So the food wasn't as good, but man, that side of the family knew how to party. So we would go there, you know, when we were old enough, get a beer or two and laugh and run around and have a great time. And so I always kind of felt like we had the best of both worlds. Now at Christmas, that side of the family that liked to drink would give better presents than the other side of the family, but the other side of the family had better food. So I always felt like we had a good dichotomy. But anyway, that was our traditions. Our holiday traditions were very much around the people that we loved and the way that they loved us. And then also, you know, my dad and I would always go hunting. The rifle opener in Maryland would be the Saturday after Thanksgiving. So we would spend the Friday oftentimes shooting our rifles, getting ready, and then we would go out and hunt on Saturday. So hunting, as with a lot of you that wrote in, hunting is a part of the Thanksgiving tradition. It's that time of year. It's the perfect time to blend the two things, which we often do. And as you'll hear from some of these other stories. So that's why I think this contest and some of your feedback on holiday traditions went the way it did. It's really about the people closest to you and spending that time with them. So appreciate that, of course. And I know that, you know, I'll try to keep this one brief, but I know that I told a lot of you guys earlier in the year about my dad. He had some heart issues earlier in the year and then came out and hunted with me. And a lot of you have continuously brought up the fact that I said earlier in the season, when I was with Clay Newcomb in the Missouri Breaks, that after my dad had hunted with me earlier this year in September, that I felt, you know, fairly desperate for him to live long enough to really see my kids get into hunting and join us in the thing that we've created, you know, our value set and our traditions. And I still do feel that, because throughout my childhood, my dad has had a couple of different issues with his heart, and he's had a couple of stints in the hospital. One of those was right around Thanksgiving, when I don't know how old I was, maybe 17. I want to say 17 or 18. And it was one of the first times I could actually drive and go hunt on my own, which I had never really done because I was always with my dad or one of my buddies or something like that. And when my dad had a heart attack and was in the hospital for getting stents put in his heart, I had the decision to make, because he was recovering and couldn't really hike, I had a decision to like go hunt on my own in a place him and I had scouted and set up on public land in Maryland, or stay home with him. And I remember pretty vividly him telling me, go, man, go. You can go. You can do this. You can do this on your own. It's not a big deal. Go and do it. And I went. And in a very, very predictable fashion, I shot a small buck on public land in Western Maryland, which is kind of how it goes there. And I remember him telling me the story, like he woke up, he couldn't sleep, he woke up early and he kind of just stood there and stared out the window because he couldn't imagine not being out hunting with me. So that was, I mean, it was a formative time for me, a tough time, but also it always underlined for that period in my life what hunting really was, which was following my dad around in the woods and being with him. And so a lot of you guys have shared that here this last couple of days. So that brings me to an email from a young lady that would rather not be named, so we won't name her, but I think one of her, it's a long story, so stick with us. But it was a story that moved me, so I'll read it to you. She says, I've enjoyed the Hunting Collective show for a while now. I've been listening to the Meat Eaters for years and Cal's Week in Review since it started. I think your show is less serious than Steve and Yanni's. I can always count it for a good laugh. I love the not-so-sharp jingle, and I sing along every time. Is the cat a voice from one of Phil's cats? Phil, you want to answer that for
I'm sorry quickly? To disappoint, but it's not. That's a great idea, though. I think I should replace it, right? That makes more sense.
Yeah, live, authentic. I'd like to have Kevin and Meatloaf both in there mixing it up together, if you don't mind.
It's a great idea.
She says, I took Hunter's Ed when I was 12. I was one of the two girls in my class, and I tied for first on the test. But do you think I have ever harvested? No. I just turned 26, and I have yet to be a successful hunter. That is partly because I am a school nerd. I can never justify going hunting over a weekend when I knew I had hours of homework to do. That mindset never changed throughout college as well. Now that I'm graduated, I have a job where I move all over the state, and I will not hunt without my dad. So it is my own fault, but I still have tried when I had the chances to go out. She says, moving on to my father. I wanted to write in because of him. I am overwhelmed with joy for his success this fall. Hunting, for most, is a pastime in which people use to get away from the regular stresses of the world. This is the same with my dad, except with a slight difference. You see, when I was 12, my older brother got into a car accident while driving to school. We are from a small town outside of Great Falls, and my brother went to high school in town. He suffered a brain injury that left him in a coma for 11 years and 9 months. Last year, 2019, on June 4th, my brother passed away from complications from both his brain injury as well as a random blood infection. It was traumatic for our whole family to lose my brother in that way after years of caring for him. Throughout my life since the beginning, when my brother got in his accident, my family did the best we could to be as normal as possible. Eventually, after my brother's initial accident, he was healthy enough for him to leave the hospital despite remaining in a coma. My father didn't hunt for a couple of seasons after my brother's accident, except to take me when I passed Hunter's Ed. Eventually, we needed to meet, and he got back into it. For the past several years, my dad has tried many times to harvest elk and deer. He was successful with a couple of cows, a small bull, and a few smaller deer here and there. Just enough to fill the freezer and be happy about it. But hunting is how he was able to escape the everyday stresses that came with caring for my older brother at home, as well as having a regular job, being a husband, and a father to me. Hunting has always been more to him than killing and punching a tag. Eventually, it got to the point my dad wasn't punching any tags for several seasons in a row. My uncle finally convinced my dad 2 years ago that he would benefit from a bow certified so he could extend his hunting season from just general rifle. However, my dad was 50 at the time, he has a bad shoulder, and my parents weren't sure about taking on a new hobby because of how expensive bow hunting can be. Well, a year goes by, and a friend of my uncle's gave him a free, brand new, hardly used Matthews bow. So this spring, in early COVID times, my dad took to the course and passed with flying colors. So now it's archery season, and he doesn't see anything. So then comes opening rifle weekend. He decides to resort back to the regular hunting rifle. Opening weekend, they were deep snow, and there was a small herd of 4 or 5 elk. Dad said the bull saw him before my dad saw the bull. He said the bull started to run when he finally spotted it. Then it went down a little hill and came up the other side, and even with my dad on the opposite hillside, it stopped and turned broadside. Dad said, he whispered to himself, that was dumb of you. He shot him dead where he stood. This bull is my dad's best bull. It was a narrow and tall 7x7. Really pretty, but not that classical wide bull you'd think of. Still, a beautiful animal. The bull he shot on the last hunt he did before my brother's accident was a 6x5. A beautiful, wide old bull. This new bull will go on the wall next to the old one, and my brother's only bull he shot the year before his own accident. Dad was so happy and grateful, he said he stopped and prayed the second he saw the bull go down. My dad has never harvested opening weekend. This is why I'm happy for him. My dad works very hard and is a determined hunter despite not always harvesting. I am extremely proud of him and his accomplishments this year. He deserves the rewards from both these hunts more than I can ever explain. And I will, honestly, this email is longer than what I read to you just now. There's more to it. But I didn't want to go too long on it. But I did want to make sure, folks, when I first read it, man, it choked me up really bad. I mean, I to think of a father going, not only going through the moment of an accident like that, but also to dealing with caring for a child for almost 12 years is tough. And if you want a shining example of the power of hunting, look no further than this story. There's so many things hunting can do, and it's so much more than just killing an animal to the people that really value it. So thank you to this young lady for writing in. I'm not sure what more I can say than I'm glad your dad filled his tags this year, and I'm glad you shared that story with us. And we got, it's actually, she sent the photos of his bull and his buck, and he had a better year than I did. So congratulations to him all the way around. Next up is Ben Upton. And I think Ben Upton wins the day. And I'll tell you why. He said, hey, Ben here. For this week's contest, I want to share with you a little Thanksgiving time tradition that I've established for myself over the past few years. I grew up in Vermont with the privilege of learning to deer hunt from my dad and grandfather on a 200-acre property that we own. It is a beautiful oak and beech forest that we actually manage for wildlife habitat, much like you all do on the Meat Eater Back 40. So even though that property isn't in your name, I'm sure you at least somehow know how special deer hunting on a family's property is to me. When I started college a few years ago on the University of Vermont, I met a lot of kids who had similar passions for the outdoors as I do, but didn't grow up with the privilege of a family of hunters and land to hunt on. I decided to make it a tradition each November to take a friend who hadn't been deer hunting before down to deer camp, lend them a rifle, lend them clothes, and take them out with me to learn how to hunt whitetails in the hardwoods. This tradition has somehow made me even more in love with hunting and strengthened my understanding of what it means to hunt and be a hunter through the reasons well beyond the scope of killing game. This year, after graduating college, I moved to Denver to hunt the Rocky Mountains and test my mettle in a whole new world of backcountry hunting, and thus didn't have the opportunity to take a new friend out with me to deer camp. But through THC, I found a way to do the next best thing. You might remember a fellow who wrote in a week or two ago named Hayes Heil. He wrote in about becoming an adult onset hunter and about the issue of wolves in Colorado. While I didn't know Hayes at all, he mentioned that he lived in Denver, and I thought it would be a cool way to continue my Thanksgiving tradition in some way. I found Hayes on Instagram and reached out to him, and I let him know that I'd love to talk about hunting with him, and even invited him to come duck hunting with me for the rest of the season. Even though this isn't exactly my tradition of taking out a brand new hunter, I still feel excited about the prospect of a new hunting buddy and the ability to share my passion for hunting with someone who didn't grow up with it like I did. Well, Phil, we're really doing it, buddy. What's your reaction to Ben? What Ben's doing over there in Colorado?
I just still can't get over how this show goes about connecting people. I'll never understand it.
Yeah, man. You know, I know we've had some funny stories before where, you know, game warden in Canada who found the guy that was trashing public lands and then found him later and said that he heard the story on our podcast and was now cleaning up public lands. But this is a little different for me. So I am with you. I don't understand how this talking into a microphone, what it means to people. I'd rather not understand it because it would be hard to do if I did. But man, thank you to Ben Upton. Thank you to Hayes and Ben. He's actually sent me a screen grab of their conversation on Instagram. And sounds like they're going to go hunt. So hopefully they check. Hopefully Hayes and Ben check back in with us and let us know how the duck hunt was in Denver. And maybe one of these days we'll get these guys out to hunt with me and you once you're a veteran hunter. Or maybe for your first hunt. We got a lot of prospects out
there. Sure, 3 years from now. Yeah.
Yeah, 3 years from now we actually get it. So all I want to say is we're going to have Mark Kenyon, and Mark's the perfect guest because we just ran episode 4 of the Back 40 is about him and his dad. I worked on that episode closely with Mark and did a lot of writing for it. And I feel like that story really is a proxy for all of our stories in terms of hunting with our fathers, but then also all of our stories for how we got into hunting and how we share it with other people. And so I just want to sincerely say thank you for writing in. Thank you for moving me. Thank you for being a part of the cult. And thank you for being a part of our lives here. And we'll keep on keeping on. So please enjoy Mark Kenyon. Hello, Mark Kenyon.
Hello, Ben O'Brien.
How you doing, sir?
Good, good. I'm, I don't know, it's like a flurry of a morning. I've just been flying around virtually. So this is my nice coffee break of the day where I can sit and chill out a little.
Oh, dude, I could only agree with you so much. I was just thinking we're getting ready to record the opening segment to this and do a bunch of other things. And I was like, man, I really want to concentrate on this, but I cannot get anything done. It's like every five seconds something is interrupting me or some ridiculous thing happens.
Yeah. Story of our lives, right?
Story of our lives. I will say, now, I was looking at, you know, they have like there's a thing I have on my phone that tells me the people I call the most.
Mm-hmm.
You're now number four.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So who's ahead of me? Your wife.
Well, my wife, thank God. My wife, my dad, and my brother. And then you.
Okay. Wow. So you're number one outside of the family.
Yeah, man. I'm feeling
pretty special about that.
Congratulations.
I'm glad we can keep it going here. The momentum is rolling.
Just keep talking to each other daily, every day, all the time, no matter what. Now, if people don't understand what I'm talking about, I work closely with Mark on the Back 40, the show that's on the Mediator YouTube channel right now. And so we're always talking about some shit that we're trying to pull off. And generally, I think we pull it off without anybody knowing how hard it is to accomplish.
Yeah, we certainly do the best we can. It's not always easy to get to the end destination. We have our ups and downs, but we get there.
Does that always feel like you could probably do this with every show, but like you could make a show about making the show. In this case, you can make a show about what it takes to like have a property, get everything together, film it, make it entertaining, try to tell a story, try to kill a deer along the way. That could be its own show.
Yeah. There might be more drama behind the scenes than in front of the camera.
I think that a few times this year, that was the case.
Yeah.
So we're editing the last couple of episodes, but you're done on the Back 40. Like it's over for you, basically.
Yeah, basically. There might be a little bit here and there, but the real deal full season, it's wrapped. And it was a weird thing wrapping up on that last day when we were closing the shop and pulling down the tent and yanking down trail cameras and all that stuff. It was a little emotional, honestly.
Yeah, we were just, in the beginning of this show, we were talking a lot about holiday traditions, and it got emotional because I think so many people that write in and tell us about why they value hunting and like what it means, especially around Thanksgiving, especially in 2020, I think a lot of people are just straight up emotional, dude. I think a lot of people are just feeling pulled in a lot of different directions. A lot of things are changing around them. A little scary every once in a while.
Yeah, it's been a crazy year. Certainly a year that gives us all, I think it's given us all a good opportunity to kind of take a step back, take stock of what matters, of the good things we do have in our lives. And if there's any tiny silver lining out of all the various challenges that have been thrown to people this year, I think maybe that forced centering that we've all had to go through, I think, is maybe a good thing. And we'll see if that can lead us to better places in 2021.
Yeah, we'll see. We announced last year a contest last week where people could tell us what their holiday traditions were, make us laugh, entertain us on the show, and then me and Phil would give people, we got like a Yeti tumbler and some Element drink mix, but also Mark, have you watched The Social Dilemma?
No, it's on my to watch list, but I haven't.
Dude, I watched it when I was in COVID lockdown. I couldn't leave the room. And I got so emotionally worked up about it that I unfollowed everybody on Instagram. except for White Claw is the only people I had to keep them on there.
That just seems like that seems on character, Ben. that's an on brand move.
Yeah, I try to keep it consistent, though. You know, I just nothing I can do.
I can just see you that night. If only we'd had a phone call that night, I would have loved to. The emotion, the concern in that moment. We're in trouble, man.
We're in trouble. Instagram is trying to kill us and brainwash us all, and now I got
unfollow,
the COVID.
Unfollow.
There was like I followed like 800 people, so it took me a while to do it, man. It took me like, you know, hours to get through it. And also I found out that Instagram, I think probably because it doesn't want people to unfollow everyone, has a little like a governor on how many people you can unfollow at one time. So I had to do like 100 and then wait an hour and then do 100 and then wait an hour. So it was a big ordeal.
So it wasn't just an impulse move. Like you got past the initial impulse and then it was, no, I'm determined. Yeah. I'm dedicated to this.
Yeah. Wow. I was like, I started looking at how much time I spent on my phone. I'm like, man, now I know how evil Silicon Valley is. It's full of a bunch of evil nerds trying to hook me to these, you know, you used to work at Google. Maybe you're just some kind of insider.
I was just going to say you're speaking of my crew.
How long you worked at Google for? Did you work at Google long enough to figure out their secret for world domination? Is the question.
Oh yeah, we learned about that on day one. I was there.
Is that what they say?
Yeah, I was there. I was there for 4 years, and so I got to put my fingerprint on that. I think you can say I dominated.
You were there for 4 years. I never really thought about how long you were there.
Yeah, four.
And what
four
what years. Did you do there? What did you do there? If you're willing to tell us, because I know it's probably something that was unscrupulous.
Yeah, basically just diving into everyone's private web browsing history and then developing databases that I could sell to. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Kidding. No, I helped online retailers or regular retailers develop online marketing strategies using various advertising and marketing tools that we had at Google. So helping people figure out how to use YouTube ads and display ads and search advertising and all that to develop a branding and marketing plan.
What did you really do? Because that sounded well rehearsed.
Go back to my first answer.
That sounds like you practiced that. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're way off track. Way off track.
What's new?
We got sappy earlier in the show because a lot of people wrote in with their holiday traditions, and a lot of them were super moving. And my normal satirical jokes just don't work right now. And it in my own head, even, because I started to get emotional about the holiday season. I wasn't able to spend this year with my family for the first time ever in my 35 mm-hmm. years. And so that got me. But then I was reading YouTube comments, which my friend Joe Rogan says never to do. But I always feel like there's such a macabre sensibility around comments on YouTube that it just makes me laugh, positive or negative.
Yeah.
But I was reading the comments on episode 4 of the Back 40. And this is, if for folks who don't know, this is an episode where you get to see Mark's dad, David, who I've never met but feel like I really have an intimate relationship with at this point. I feel like I was reading the comments and that itself warmed my heart because there's hundreds of comments. I don't know how many there'll be when this airs, but hundreds of comments, and almost all of them were positive and uplifting, and people felt moved by the hunt with you and your dad. Yeah. Have you read any of those? Did you bring
them? Yeah, I did break our cardinal rule and looked at those. And I looked because I was hoping that it would resonate with people in that way. And so it was cool to see that. It was cool to see that it connected with people, that the relationship that my dad and I had and with my son and the journey that we tried to share with people, that came across and was something that people could relate to and connect with. Of everything that we do here at Mediator with our podcasts and our articles and our TV shows and everything like that, for me at least, the greatest thing, the greatest achievement, the greatest goal to work towards is to is to connect with someone in that kind of way, where they feel something, where you change them, even if it's for a couple seconds on a Tuesday, in some small way. So to see that, you know, in some way we did that, it makes all those late nights and all that work worth it, Ben.
Yeah. Yeah. It's being you in a hole working on the back 40. Not that there's a lot of other people that put a lot of effort into it, but it does. You know, when I think about that show and I think about this time of year, and I'm glad we can do this today, because it all kind of seems like it collides in a way that is, you know, that makes sense to me. Because your relationship with your dad is it is emblematic of my own relationship with my father. And to tell your story as a proxy for all of our stories, for those of us that are in a situation like you and I, where we grew up on with our dads, we built these traditions, we built these connections. These are things that kind of drive us to this day. And it becomes like a cycle of payback, like we talk about in that episode. Like, you feel like, I'm the same way. My dad comes hunting with me now, and I'm the one going, like, we got to go here. We got to do this. We got to call now. We got to bop, bop, bop. And that's the relationship I have with my dad. And you, throughout that episode, display that, but it also makes you feel like that's giving back to the guy that even told you that this could be a possibility for your life.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much of that. A little bit of a role reversal and a wanting to pay it, like you said, pay it back in some kind of way. And you know, my dad gave me so much over the years, whether it be take me out in the woods or teaching me these things about hunting or life. And now that I have these new opportunities, that I've been able to kind of take the baton that he passed to me when I was young, and I took that forward and I went further with it and in different directions with it. Now it's a really exciting and maybe satisfying thing to be able to now bring him along on the new journeys I took and show him where I took the baton to. It's hard to put words on a lot of this stuff without it seeming like over the top sappy. You know, I know we've talked about this when we were working on the episode, like, how do you say something without having to say it over and over again? But yes, being able to share something like this with someone like a father in this case, who was there for you when you were young, and you can be there again later in life for them, is a powerful thing. And I'm just really, really glad I was able to do that, and that things came together in this circumstance, and excited to continue trying to do more things like that in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like you can see it in this episode. And one of the things I think people would notice in their own lives, you know, in terms of the intensity of their own emotion and connection to what they're doing. If you look at your dad and look at you throughout that episode, you see, like, just look at your face, look at your eyes, look at the way that you react to things, look at, you know, kind of the intensity with which the joy and the pain and, like, this, you know, all that stuff, it comes out because there is so much emotion built on decades of hunting together and wanting to in this case get him his first archery buck. And so those stories are enduring. I know it in my own life. I am happier and more fulfilled when my dad's along, no matter what we're doing, but especially hunting, because we've built up 20 years of this story together, and every time we go, it's another chapter in the story, you know.
Yeah. You know, something that struck me in the comments on that video that I'm reminded of this somewhat often, but it was another important reminder, was how many people said, man, you're so lucky that you got to do that, that your dad's still around to have moments like that. You know, cherish those. And it's so easy for us, and for a lot of people, I'm sure, who are in this part of our lives where we have kids and we have really busy jobs and we're trying to do all these things, and it's just go, 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 go. It's so easy to lose sight of, you know, staying connected with your family sometimes, of taking time to do something like that, of stepping away from whatever your goal or mission or job description is, whatever it is, and take some time to call dad, to go and have dinner with mom, to whatever it is. One of these days you're not gonna be able to do that. And I think this was, in a strange way, a reminder for me that, yeah, you know, you better take advantage of this while you can.
What'd your dad say about all this?
He hasn't seen it yet.
Oh, no?
He hasn't seen it yet. I called him this morning, and he was looking for it last night, and it wasn't up yet. And then this morning, he's been in meetings all day. So I have not heard from him yet after watching. I'm sure. I don't know if he's going to have a lunch break or something today. Maybe he did get to watch it. Or if not, he'll watch it tonight. And I'm very interested to see what he thinks. I think he'll be really happy with it.
I hope so. If he's not, I mean, you know, let me know.
Yeah, scratch. Take it down.
Take it down. Delete it. Yeah, I get what you're saying too, because I do. Now that we Phil and I were talking about this earlier, when you look back, you know, I moved away from home. You haven't really moved away from home, and you still
2 hours away.
Yeah,
but I mean, not that far.
Not that far. I moved a long way away. Phil moved a long ways away. And then when the traditions you had around, especially around holidays, but also around hunting and the cross section of those two things, when you start to think about when that goes away, right? When I can't just drive over and hunt with my dad for the opening Saturday after Thanksgiving, then you start to realize what that meant to you. And when you're a kid, it's just life, you know? Yeah. Going to your grandparents' house for Thanksgiving is just life. That's just what you do. It's how you function. And then when it's not there anymore, you sit back like, how can I recreate that? Because I'd love to have that back. Mm-hmm. And I think hopefully, you know, that episode can be that for a lot of people. This is a proxy of saying, listen, if you didn't have a dad or a mom who took you hunting or a family that took you hunting, you can create that for someone else. Like, you have the opportunity to create what you didn't have for someone else inside of hunting. And so I do like that note we hit with your kid there with Everett at the end, because I think that is important for people to know. Like, if you didn't have it, you can create it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I was just super lucky to have it in spades. I mean, I had a wonderful dad and grandpa and uncles who brought me along and made me a part of it, and it changed my life. It completely changed the direction of my life and made me who I am in a lot of ways. So, yeah, I cannot wait to continue bringing my boys along that same route, and whatever, you know, who knows what they'll end up being interested in, but at least for the moment, my oldest son seems to be out of control into it, constantly recreating hunting shows and pretending to be hunting at all hours of the day. Loves animals, loves the outdoors. So I'm just thoroughly enjoying this new part of life too.
Yeah, I'm right there alongside. And I always wonder how much are they going to really build up this idea of hunting, because they see me doing it so much, they hear me talking about it so much. How much are they going to build it up to be more than it was when I was a kid? Because when I was a kid, I'm just, like we said in this episode, I'm just following my dad around. Like, I didn't think I have to have this buck, or I have to take this photo, or I have to have this experience. I just followed my dad, and whatever he did, I did, and that's all I wanted. And that's, there was nothing else for me. You know, and then I got old enough to change that, but, you know, I want that for my kids, the simplicity of it. You know, I don't want them to be thrown into the world that I'm in right now. I want them to have some babe in the woods years, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it will be really interesting. I've thought about that too, like how different the circumstances are that my sons are coming into. While we both were little kids and families that love the outdoors, my son is definitely thrown into something cranked up to 15 compared to, you know, I was at level 6 maybe. So yeah, I don't know what that means. I hope it doesn't mean that it's going to be eventually too much for him and he wants to rebel away from it. So I want to make sure not to force him into anything. I hope it just means that he will find his own passion within this somewhere else, and he'll chase that. But I hope we can foster within Everett and my other son, Colt, a love for these things that they can appreciate in their own way.
Yeah, you and I are tracking along the same kind of a child having schedule, right? I mean, we're mating at the same times of the year.
Basically. It's because there's only one. We have like 2 nights a year when we're not working. And so, it's like, hey, you going to go to, yeah, oh yeah, yeah, me too. All right, well,
let's
talk to you in 9 months.
That's true.
I think that's it.
Because I feel like, so my son James is, well, we got a little bit of a gap there. My son James is 4.
1 year off.
One year off. But then our second, once we started working together immediately, our second sons, yeah. Asher and Cole, are lined right up, man. What's it like within days, I feel?
Within days. 3 or 4 or 5, something like that.
Yeah. Then this may now evolve into like a daddy daycare podcast where we talk about all the shit you gotta do.
Lots to talk about there.
Well, it's good. If you haven't watched it, everybody, go watch episode 4. I think it's one of the better. Capture Creative, shout out to Justin and Taylor, yeah, and Jordan and everybody at Capture Creative, and Charlie, who put this together. I think they did an exceptional job helping us tell the story, and I'm, yeah, I'm happy for you, man. I'm happy that you have this kind of time capsule to show your kids and to explain, yeah, those things to them.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Is what a special thing just for my own little family that we could look back on this and someday relive this moment in a way that does capture the emotions, I think, in a real way. So yeah, selfishly, this is a pretty nice thing to have. And my son just watched it this morning, and he was really excited about it. So he'll be watching it on replay for a number of days, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's thinking about kids, too. My wife and I were watching the Steve, what's that guy's name? Oh, what's the old comedian? Shit. It's called Parenthood. Steve, help me out here, Mark.
Steve Martin?
Steve Martin, there it is. We're watching the old Steve Martin movie, Parenthood, and in this movie, he's all stressed out about what his kids are going to be, and he keeps visualizing like his kids being the valedictorian or some sort of like shooter on the bell tower, and like what he did, what he did to cause that. And I told my wife, I'm like, I turned this off. This is the most anxiety-inducing movie I've ever watched my entire life. I do not want to listen to this crap, because now I got to think about, and I was thinking about hunting. I'm like, am I going to overexpose my kid to this, and he's going to be like, he's going to be a vegan at age, you know, 10? Like, what do I got to do here? But
in a few years, he starts the Vegetable Collective, yeah, as a podcast.
Damn it.
Just point counterpoint against Ed.
Yeah. Damn it. What do I do? So anyway, that stressed me out. We did turn. I was like, turn that off, man. Turn it off. I can't watch. So we watched National Lampoon's Christmas deal, which helped out. Classic. What did you tell me the other day that you were watching like a Christmas movie? What's like? What's your movie go to for Christmas time?
Well, right now it wasn't even like us Christmas movies. It was a kid Christmas movie. I'm trying to think I don't think it was last time. It was the night before. We put on the old like puppet Santa Claus Comes to Town, like the original Christmas movies from the 60s.
Creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. My boys love them. So this is the story of how little baby Santa Claus got raised by these elves. And then he was trying to bring presents to this town with Burgermeister, Meisterburger. And then he eventually becomes Santa, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, that was our click.
Creepy, man. That's those little puppet ones creep me out. Yeah. Big time. Big time. Big time. All right. Well, we're down the rabbit hole pretty far. There's nothing we want to talk about when we were talking the other day. And I think it's not unique. I don't know. We'll see if we can figure this out. But I feel like it's unique to whitetail hunters, core whitetail hunters, people that do it and that's all they think about. There's a lot of this in the waterfowl space, in the whitetail space, in the elk space. And people become one species, addicted or focused, right? The difference, I think the big difference in the whitetail world, as I see it, is that nobody names a duck. And if they do, they got problems. And I don't know a lot of people that name elk. People do, but it's not as commonplace as it is in the whitetail space.
Yeah.
And so I feel like a place to start in terms of the whitetail community, the people, and when I say community, I mean people that self-identify as whitetail hunters. Like, what do you do? Oh, I'm a whitetail hunter. Those are the people I'm talking about. I was very much one of those people early on in my life and hunting career. All I thought about was whitetails. So I know the feeling. But I think we have to start at naming deer, or maybe better described, hunting a single deer or a couple of deer or target animals.
Yeah.
Giving them names and having a relationship. Have you thought about the psychology of that? Like what it does to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get from the outside in, from the outside looking in, it seems bizarre. I understand that. And even from the inside looking in, I can see it being bizarre. But there is, it just makes sense when you have to actually live within the box that we as many whitetail hunters do, which for a lot of folks involves hunting relatively small places and hunting them over and over and over and over again. And when you do that, you're presented a different hunting experience than someone who lives out west who hunts miles and miles and miles of country, who has millions of acres to roam. When you're hunting 40 acres, when you're hunting 64 acres, and that's what you're doing for every weekend or weeks on end, you're going to see the same deer over and over. You may only have one buck you actually want to hunt. If you go into this and you have certain goals, like for me, I'm at the point where most of the time when I'm hunting some of these small properties I spend a lot of time on in Michigan, it's a four-year-old buck or older is where I've kind of set the goal for myself that's going to allow me to have to work really, really hard and have to do things well and have to get better year after year and have a long, challenging, exciting, interesting hunting season. That is how I try to craft my experience here hunting in Michigan, because if I just wanted to fill my freezer right away, I could do that. And I want to fill the freezer, but I also want to have this set of experiences alongside filling the freezer, which is why I have these goals. So when you do that, you see these deer and you inevitably want to talk about them. So if I was just a random person that didn't have a podcast and a show and all these things, you still might end up referring to these deer by something, because when you share the experience with friends, which is one of the most fun things about hunting, is telling the stories, right? You want to share what happened. It just becomes practically inconvenient to just try to describe the deer over and over again. Yeah, I saw that same, 10 pointer that's got the dark patch underneath his neck and two spots on his left shoulder and maybe a little crab claw on the left. If I had to say that in a conversation over and over and over again, it just wouldn't make sense. So you can eventually, just call, it was the 110 pointer. Or maybe you describe a little more, oh, it's the wide 10. Or maybe you want to get creative with it and call him something funky like Tim. Whatever. I think the simple fact of it is it makes talking about and sharing, and then even in your own head thinking about these animals, just a little simpler, because you're going to do it over and over and over. So that's what it comes down to for a lot of us. And then for me, having all these different platforms where I'm sharing this story, it becomes a necessity to help, describe these experiences. And because I do have, in many cases, experiences with the same deer for multiple years, where I'm getting to learn about one of these specific deer, and kind of by default, because I don't have a bunch of land, I'm hunting, my main property that I hunt a lot is a little over 80 acres, but half of it is just wide open fields by the road. So really it's a little over 40 acres of huntable ground that I have permission to hunt. And then I have permission on a couple little like 20 acre, 30 acre sections in the same general area around that. So I'm hunting little tiny stuff. I don't have hundreds and hundreds or thousands of acres to work here. So in any given year, I'm lucky if I've got one buck that is, that is the kind of deer I want to hunt on a given year. So yeah, I'm hunting a deer. And when that's the case, you give it a name so you can talk about it and you can think about it, and then you watch it and you see trail camera pictures of it, and it becomes a really interesting, really frustrating at times kind of one-on-one duel. When you go into the woods and you're constantly thinking, you walk out there in the dark in the morning and you hear a doe or you hear a deer blow and run off. And right then it's like, well, that could be my hunt. That could have been the only one deer. There might be 70 deer in this square mile, but there's only one of them that I'm after. And there's only one of them that can make this hunt, what I'm trying to make it be. So it can be unbelievably frustrating, because you know that you make one tiny mistake with that one animal, the one chance you have, it's all shot. On the flip side, that challenge is also really fascinating. Trying to go deep. Something I like about deer hunting and why I'm so fascinated by deer hunting. Yeah, I love all hunting. I've loved going out elk hunting. I've tried bear hunting. It's awesome. I've tried pronghorn hunting. It's awesome. I've been caribou hunting. It was great. All these things are really cool. I want to keep doing them. But something about whitetail hunting that has just made it, just has consumed me, is the level of depth that you can go with it. I love deep experiences where you can really dive into the nitty gritty, studying habitat, studying behavior, studying how wildlife react to outside factors and conditions like the weather and the moon and precipitation, and barometric pressure and hunting pressure, and trying to look at all the probabilities of all these different things that might happen in a given day, and then sorting through all these puzzle pieces that you've collected, all this data you've collected, and try to take all these dots and connect them in a way that makes sense, so that you, on this one time, in this one perfect place, with this one perfect set of conditions, can kill that one deer in this small, tiny area where there's 20 other guys surrounding you trying to do the same thing. That's the hardest thing I've ever tried to do, and it's also the most satisfying, both the process of itself, and then when you actually do finally accomplish that goal every once in a while, man, that's something. So that's a long, rambling way of explaining why I named deer.
So you're saying you've thought this out?
I guess so.
There's two things that interest me in what you just said. One, I think is the most interesting, is the turn from the practicality to the emotionality of the relationship. Because we talk about relationships with animals, right? We talk about it from the set of animal rights activists to vegans to us as hunters. And we generally talk about relationships in a way like, I have a relationship with the idea of the animal, right? I have a relationship with the wild, a relationship with a habitat or ecosystems. That is like the broad relationship means something. But a lot of people don't get to experience a relationship with an animal. It even seems weird to describe it like that. But where you have multiple years of experience with one animal, you're through that animal, you're learning so much about the idea of, you know, in a case of a buck, you're learning so much through that animal. He's a proxy for your own knowledge of the habitat where he lives and his relationship with other deer. And that itself is interesting. And so where, like, can you describe the turn, the psychological turn from where it's like, I got to describe this deer, right? Oh, it's the wide eight. It's the big 10. It's, you know, Tran. It's like, I'm just going to call him something so people know what I'm talking about. But then at some point with a few of these animals, not all of them, but a few of them, you have so many encounters. You think about them so much. You strategize so much that, and people will probably get tired of me saying this, but I do believe that the game-like quality of hunting is one of the things that draws us to it. And so now you have this like 1v1, you know, first person game that you're playing with this animal, and that it turns things. It turns things psychologically just in a different way, and your value system becomes, you know, shifts.
Yeah, and there's like 1,000 different aspects of that. Because you're right, there's a whole lot of different things that pop up when you have that shift, both good and bad. From the good side, you know, as you spoke, you kind of get these animals become the analog for the larger species. So you can learn a lot about the general through the specific. And there's this fascinating aspect that you can actually begin to see where there's actually, you know, we often try to talk about animals from the higher level, like from the species level. We should manage from the species level, from the population level. We should, you know, let's not anthropomorphize. Let's not go so deep into the individual, but animals are individuals. And when you start spending this much time around them, you see the individual qualities and tendencies and, you know, for lack of a better term, personalities. And that is both fascinating and eye-opening. And you do see stuff that sometimes you're like, man, like there's a lot going on here. And I don't even know what I mean by that. But when
let me stop you for a minute and ask you this question, because it pops in my head. I've had a lot, as you know, I've had a lot of animal rights folks on this show, a lot of vegans, a good number of them. We talk about things. And one of the things that we always talk about is this idea of the individual animal, right? Animal rights folks see animals in an individualistic fashion, right? I see the animal. I see the mother. I see the wolf as a mother,
you know, and I see the alpha male as a father and their pups as children. I see them. We use this term anthropomorphization all the time, but it's just a way of saying, like, I see myself in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have an example of you as a hunter, and I've done this too, so it's not a community of hunters that is centering around the same idea, but yet, you know, obviously with a different end game. And so do you ever think about the dichotomy between, like, how you, like, Tran is a buck that you've hunted for years. You know that buck. You know where he lives. You probably know who, like, where his kids are hanging out.
Seen a few.
Yeah. So, you, like, you have this relationship, and it becomes an individualistic relationship, much like some of these animal rights folks I've talked to. But it manifests itself in a completely, entirely different way.
Yeah, and you're right. It is kind of a wild thing to think about in that kind of context, and the bizarre parallels there. And I will say, like, right, I can't deny the individual aspects of these animals. But I can also, I also realize that the individual is still part of the larger population, and I can also separate myself from it emotionally and understand the reality of what's happening out here, whether I'm a part of it or not. And so because I think of the way I engage with these animals, I'm able to have a certain, while still there's certainly a relationship, there's also a certain ability to separate myself from that individual lens while also looking at the big picture of what this thing is. This thing is, this is wildlife. This is nature. A system of animals and plants and elements that are going to go round and round and round and round, regardless of me being a part of it. And it's beautiful, and it's ugly, and it's bloody, and it's life and death, and all those things happen. If you have an opportunity like I've had to see glimpses of that up close, or as many of us hunters have in different circumstances, I think you come to not only see the beauty in that individuality, but also respect for the larger whole too. Yeah. So I think that's what I've taken from it. And yeah, there are some weird things though, where when you say relate, like you addressed this earlier, it sounds weird when you say, like, oh, I've got a personal relationship with a deer. It's a weird thing to say. This is for lack of a better term. I don't know how to better describe it, but
yeah.
There's a deer that I have watched for 3 years, and the first year was like, man, that's a great buck, but I'm hunting a different deer this year. I'm gonna pass on him this year, but he's gonna be the one next year. And so I'm watching, studying, taking notes, look for his shed antlers in the winter. The next year it's all about him making plans, adjusting things, thinking about what did he do last year, what's he gonna do this year, get out there scouting all the time, glassing, I mean, spending hours and hours and hours watching for this deer from hilltops and trees, and getting out there and seeing him and having these incredibly exhilarating experiences where you finally see this animal you've been looking for, and you're watching him and you're learning more, and you have close calls, and it comes together or it doesn't come together, and it's frustrating and it's exciting, and this happens over and over and over. You eventually get to a point where maybe it does come together, like it did for me a week ago. I killed this deer I've been after for 3 years. So many different experiences with this creature. And you have this very paradoxical set of emotions where I'm so excited and relieved and happy that I finally killed this animal that was my goal, but I'm also, once I stepped away from it, like, wow, how much emptier are the woods gonna be now that he's not out there? Yeah. So a certain sense of, I don't know if remorse is the right word, because, you know, my goal was to go out there and kill a deer. And I did that, and I'm going to feed my family, and I had this set of experiences, but you can't ignore the fact that something else happened here too. And that something else is not there anymore. I'll have this story, and I'll have these memories, and I'll have this meat and these lessons learned that, you know, will sustain me for a long time. And I am really, really appreciative for, but that thing is gone. So there's a certain sadness that comes about from that too.
I would think, like, it, you know, I think the important point to make, and the thing that I see and what you go through and I go through, and a lot of hunters go through, in terms of that the game we play and then the remorse at the back end. And definitely like the individual relationship with an animal is that the knowledge that animals are in them in of themselves individuals, right? They do have their own personalities. They do things a certain way, like is important to understand animals themselves. That's an important thing to do. The difference, I think, between a vegan and somebody like you or me is not only do we understand the individual characteristics of an animal, that that's important, and that they have their own kind of way and their own personality. Like, that's an important thing to understand. But at the same time, you have to understand the larger picture. And where a lot of the folks I've had on the show that are animal rights activists stop is understanding. They understand the emotion, the emotional connection to an individual animal, but they stop at the realistic and pragmatic application of conservation and hunting and resource management and things of that nature. And yeah. so it's while you share, and I always say this, while you share some sensibility with them, they stop at a very important point where you keep going, right?
Yeah, that's the truth. And while the diverting paths that why in the road is a pretty important one and leads to very different places. You know, I think it is important that we can remember that we do share that respect and genuine caring for these animals and fascination with these animals. And I guess if there's anything that can come from those conversations you're having, I hope it's that people can see and rally around some type of shared sensibility there. Because yeah, you know, there's probably a lot of things we've got in common with some of these people. I love these animals. I love these places. I love these creatures. I love watching them, learning about them, studying them. And we can probably do some good things together if we can somehow learn to live with our differences at the back end.
I have a dream is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's what I'm shooting for.
That's one thing I wanted to address. But another thing I think that's important to address is the more internal struggle within hunting. And this is probably also without, like, there are a lot of people want to label what you do as trophy hunting, right? This mm-hmm. is a term that we'll deal with the semantics of it and the reality of it for as long as we probably do what we do. And so now you got to deal with this idea that trophy hunting is defined in a lot of different ways, but a lot of people that we've collected in our company, a lot of people that come and listen to us really like the meat, and they really don't understand why you would sacrifice some delicious meat for a bigger set of antlers or a more mature deer, et cetera, et cetera. So like I said, people, you know, it's something I bring up all the time, but I do feel like it's real. Everybody plays the game of hunting differently, and everybody mm-hmm. is looking for a different set of experiences that ultimately lead to an end game, whether that end game is meat or antlers or both, often both, is up to the individual. But like, can you explain from your perspective how you see the entanglements of labeling, you know, within and without hunting? I mean, because we're all calling it something, trophy hunting, you know, subsistence hunting, it's going to be labeled.
Yeah. So my first thought is that I just really dislike the term trophy hunting. I think it brings up the wrong set of images and connotations that right away colors a certain segment of the hunting world in a really negative way that brings all these negative assumptions to bear that I do not think are accurate for the lion's share of people that someone might lump into trophy hunting. But let me, you know, it's hunting. Hunting is hunting. So I think screw subsistence hunting, screw trophy hunting, screw all these specifics. Let's just say we're hunting. We're all going to hunt, though, with our own set of goals and our own ways and places and experiences and set of experiences that we're trying to achieve within that. So for me, the way I look at it is this. When I started hunting, I just wanted to kill my first deer, and that was a really hard thing to do. It took me a long time to figure it out, and then I finally did, and I killed that deer, and I got that meat, and I had that experience. And then it was, okay, now can I do it again? Can I figure out how to do this, you know, year after year? And so I kept doing that. But eventually I figured all that stuff out. And then it got to the point where I can kill it. I can do it. I can get my meat and fill my freezer day one, day two, if I wanted. I've kind of figured a certain group of things out that make that a non-issue. It's going to happen. But for me, at the same time, over the course of my lifetime, I was learning the how to, I was also learning the why to. So why am I doing this? And I found that I was doing it not just to put meat in the freezer, but also because all the things that revolve around it, because of the people I got to spend time with, because of the time I got to spend outside in nature, because of this, as I just described, the work and the time and the study that's required to get sufficient at doing this. That process of learning about animals, about studying a landscape, studying and learning about habitat, spending time out there just watching and waiting, all of that stuff. I love it. I love it. It's what turns like the gears in my body on. It's like what gets me going, engaging with wild things like that. Like that's the thing for me. So why would I personally want to begin and end the thing that gets me going in one day? No, I don't want to do that. I want to enjoy this process as much as I possibly can. And I want to find ways, and maybe this isn't going to be the case for everybody, right? Everyone's going to have a different way they want to do this. Everyone's going to want something different out of hunting. But for me, because it's something that has grown into really what my life revolves around, I want to find ways to extend that and to deepen it. So I want to have a deeper experience. So what that has become for me is steadying a steady evolution of my goals. So at first, like I described, I just wanted to get a deer. And then I wanted to, you know, consistently kill a buck every year. And then it was, eventually, I want to see if I can kill a three-year-old buck. Because this is an older deer. They're rarer. They're more rare. They're harder to kill. They're a little more savvy. And then it was a four-year-old. And so steadily, it was, what can I do to both create a set of circumstances that requires I get better, that requires I spend more time, which requires I go deeper into this thing, while also challenging myself in new ways to learn and to go further in all of these things that I love. That's what having some kind of higher level set of goals, what some people would say trophy hunting related goals, does for me. That's why I hold out for bigger, older deer, because I want to take things to a different level, because I love that. It's not because I just need some big set of antlers on the wall. It's because I need everything that comes along with that, which is time, which is study, which is work, which is passion, which is persistence, which is dealing with a whole bunch of shit going wrong and somehow pushing through it and getting to the other side. That kind of stuff that hunting forces me to participate in is why this is such a deep, special thing for me. So that's why I do this. I know everyone's a little different. So for me, I think trophy hunting makes someone think that, oh, I'm just waiting to kill one. I'm passing on all these other deer because I just want this huge racked buck, and all I'm going to do is cut off his head and stick it on my wall and tell everyone, look at me, I'm a big bad hunter and I kill big deer. And that's not the case. But at the same time, I go through all those things I just described. And when I do kill a deer and I, you know, I'm going to bring that meat home. And yeah, I am going to bring the antlers home too. And maybe I will put those on my wall too, because that signifies and symbolizes all of these other experiences I just described. All that work, all that time, all that passion and love and respect and fascination. Every time I'm able to go and look at the antlers in my office or in the den next to me and tell my son the stories, it brings all those things back to life. And it allows me to continue experiencing those things years and years later. So I wouldn't call them trophies, but I would call them something really damn important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's two ways that I've come to think about this. And I think the way that you describe it is the way that I describe it. And the way that everybody that I think that has over time here really wanted to dive into the why has passionately expressed, like, this is a thing that addicts people. It is a thing that draws you in a way that nothing else in my life, and I know your life, has. I played lots of games, football, soccer, baseball. I've played chess. I ran. I never very fast, but one time I tried to run in a marathon. Whatever. All of those things are akin to this, but this has a different ways of being expressed. And if you think of it my theory of hunting as a game. A game is a series of interesting choices. And those interesting choices, like navigating those choices and through the course of play, reveals, and especially in hunting, it reveals who you are, how you think, and what you value. And that's why the duality, the two truths of hunting, are that everybody should be able to do it the way they want, and everybody shouldn't be able to do it the way they want. This is a duality of hunting that is super interesting for me to look at, because there's like shades of gray within that duality that are important to understand. Because you did say, like, in the beginning there, like, don't label me. I'm going to do what I want to do. And you're right. Don't label me. But at the same time, you can't do what you want to do. We have to confine things, right?
There's going
to
be some running boards on either side. But within that framework, within what's legal, then I think, you know, we can all have our own experience. So, yeah, there's just like government. Right? We want to have our freedoms. We want to be able to do what we want to do. We don't want the government telling us what to do. But you know what? Actually, we do want the government to tell us not to murder people, and we do want the government to do certain things. So I think the same thing goes with this too. There's got to be some set of guidelines. There's got to be some type of legal framework to keep us on the straight and narrow. But then within those frameworks, let's have our own experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to me, especially because I know what you're doing and what I do. If I had a chance to hunt the same giant elk every year until it got as big as possible and then kill it, that's exactly what I would do. To your point earlier, I just can't find them. There's millions of acres.
Right.
And I'm also not real good at it, but I mean, there's millions of acres and it just isn't a reality. I once heard somebody say out west, like, I would never be able to name an animal because I've never seen most animals I kill. I've never seen more than once.
Right.
And so there is the difference within hunting right there. I mean, it's hard to understand each other when you're playing different games.
Different places, different types of animals. I mean, white-tailed deer have small home ranges typically. Yeah. They hang out in little areas. It's going to be a lot different with an elk that can roam miles and miles frequently. I'll tell you what, you know, it is, to go deep like that with one animal is a lot of fun and it's fascinating, like I just said. It can also be, though, incredibly frustrating when you go from having a very target rich environment where there's all sorts of deer that you could kill and hunt and shoot and you know, you could achieve your goal readily. When it goes down to just one deer, it makes it nearly impossible. And so 99.99% of the times you go hunt, you are not going to achieve the goal that you set out with. And that is a whole nother conversation about the negative aspects of that and the frustration that can come with that and how you can deal with that. Because I can tell you what, my hunts like this are huge roller coasters where you go from the highest to highest to the lowest to lows. And lots of times I'm like, man, is this even fun anymore? And then the next day I'll be like, yes. But I'll have these moments where it's really challenging. But I guess for me, that's, I guess I like that. I like things that force me to have that wild set of ups and downs and challenges and something that you don't think you're going to be able to pull it off and you want to, and you, yes, I can do it. I don't know if it'll ever come to, yes, I can do it. This isn't going to happen. Damn it. I'm going to keep trying. Maybe I'm just, I don't know if it was that masochistic, something like that.
No, man, I've read a lot about some of this stuff and philosophical terms. Like with a game, imagine if you had like an X and Y axis, right? If you had this, and this was challenge of the game, right? And it's an arrow pointing up to forever. And this right here was skill level, and it's an arrow pointing to forever. Mm-hmm. As the challenge of the game increases, so must your skill level. As your skill level increases, so must the challenge of the game to keep you entertained.
Yeah.
And so, like, as you think about those X and Y axes in the example of hunting, it's what you're doing. What you just described as a kid, the challenge of the game is limited and your skill level is limited. And so just killing a deer for the meat or a spike, I mean, we talked about it in the back 40 with your level of where you were at Ken Roven. Those things, like, I'll put my fingers down now, but like, standing like this, you follow me? We play paper football and we're done. Yeah. But that's what happened to me as a young kid. Now I am at a different level. My dad didn't follow me along the track, right? Of the skill level and the challenge of the game. He kind of stayed where he was, and as did your dad, which we'll probably, if we get lucky, our kids will surpass us and their skill level and the challenge that they need. And so when you start thinking of it in these terms, it makes way more sense. You know, you don't have to say things like, well, you know, over time, I just want to kill bigger bucks. You're like, no, over time, my skill level, I can, what you just said earlier fits into a nice little picture where the more the challenge of the game, the more the anxiety, the more the skill level, the less the anxiety, and those things match up together. Mm-hmm. And that gets you where you are.
Yeah. And you know, I talk about this a lot on my podcast too. And I always think it's important to point out the fact that it doesn't have to be this way. Right? You don't need to feel like if you're getting into hunting or you're on this road that you have to keep going further and further down that X axis or further and further up that Y axis. You don't need to do what I've done or what you've done, Ben. If you want, you know, find wherever on that graph you are happy, wherever it works for you, and be happy there. I don't think there has to be this pressure that you have to keep taking it to the next level and the next level. If you want to, awesome. If you don't, that's awesome too. We're all going to have a different place on that graph that feels right for us. So it's, you know, keep exploring, find your place, enjoy it, make it what you need it to be.
Yeah. And if you're looking, like, if you're inside of hunting and you want to label somebody, or outside of hunting and want to label somebody, think about when you just say trophy hunting, how much of the intricate of the details that you're displacing by saying that. And when you think of somebody who's a trophy hunter who really wants to kill the biggest, the most mature thing out there, think about it in this discussion, because it's true. A person is not driven to kill the biggest buck 10 years into their hunting experience because they're now addicted to the antlers and driven by ego. They're doing that because they're following the track of the game, like quality of hunting. That's what they're doing. That's all that they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's not a change. It's not an evil change in their mentality. It's a natural progression of how anybody plays a game. And at some level, as long as we admit that we're playing a game, you know, we're okay.
Have you had the conversation with anyone about the idea of referencing this as a game, though? Do you have any qualms with that? I bring that up because I get what you're saying, 100%. But I also worry about language like game being attached to hunting, trivializing the serious nature of it.
Sure.
And the fact that the end game, for lack of a better term, is...
Oh, we're getting good now. A couple of pro podcasters. Right? Yeah, no, I'm with you. And that's why I try to always say hunting has game-like qualities. And that's one of the things that attracts us psychologically to it.
Yeah, no doubt. It's
not that it's a game. You're not out there to score points. Now, social media, you may defer there. There is some point scoring that happens there. But that happens for everybody that goes and spends time on social media. Right, and that's why I only follow White Claw.
and that's why I watch The Social Dilemma.
White Claw ain't playing any games with anybody. They just want you to drink as much alcohol as possible in a very fruity way. But anyway, I think... the expression of hunting is a game is wrong. Hunting has qualities, attractive qualities, akin or mirrored by a video game or any other game that we play, any other competition that we have. And that's what leads to where you are, I think, and where I am, and where a lot of people that we hang out with are. It's more complex.
And I think that's what makes hunting so singularly powerful, more so than like someone who loves basketball or someone who loves soccer or loves poker, is the fact that hunting has that, those game like qualities, but then it also has this incredibly complex, deep life or death set of elements that connects you to something that's a wormhole into a whole nother world.
Yeah.
And those two things combined set hunting in a different arena than almost anything else. Which is both why it's controversial in some circles and why it's something so deeply loved by folks within our circles.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's something, isn't, wouldn't you agree that there's something ironic about playing, like, we're playing at hunting. We, dude, I can go get a steak tomorrow. It'd be delicious. Right. We're playing a very human game, right? We are, we are participating in a very game-like way in something that people used to do for essential human survival, right?
Yeah.
So there is something ironic about that. I get that.
Sure.
You know, I understand that that's probably, that can be hard for people to understand. But that's, I mean, I think that's true throughout the modern sense of humanity. Like, oh, yeah. We, you know, throwing a football is like throwing a rock on the savannah, you know, a million years ago. Like, we are expressing.
Planting a garden.
Yeah, planting a garden. We're expressing our humanity. Wood. Yeah.
Yeah. We want to do things that connect with, you know, the essential humanness of what we are and what we were and where we came from. And yeah, hunting is a way to do that. A real tactile way to do that. And, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, we could talk about it forever, I'm sure. I do, you know, when it's cool to, when a topic comes up, because I know your show, you don't talk about shit like this very often. I mean, you do and sometimes. Don't. You do and don't. But yeah, I mean.
But not
I
as listen. Often as you do.
Yeah, I listen. And I know, like, it's cool to see the celebration of that singular focus and the way that you described earlier on that, like, it's so, it's endless. Dude, it's endless. The depth of just hunting whitetails in Michigan on 150 acres is endless. And that is a nice way to think about the natural world. It is fucking endless.
Yeah.
And you pick, just pick a small part of it and live the rest of your life trying to learn it. And you're not going to get there.
Yeah, you're not going to. You'll be constantly surprised. And you will learn new things about these places, these animals, yourself. Yeah, yeah, that's, you can't beat the natural world. I mean, that's where we came from, and that's where I keep on going back to, because it's just, like you said, it's endless. There's, everything we need is there, Ben. Everything we need is right there.
All right, well, let's go back to work. Let's go make some more hunting TV and keep talking about it. We got, what, episode 5, episode 6 of the Back 40?
Yeah, got a couple more we're just frantically cranking out.
Oh, man, it's going to be fun. All right, we'll go over there, subscribe, and watch Mark toil on 64 acres in Michigan for a couple more weeks before it's all over, and we'll see what we do next. All right, man, good talk to you, brother, always.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
See ya. That's it. That's all. Another episode in the books. Thank you to Mr. Kenyon. Thank you to all the listeners out there for writing in with your holiday traditions. You kind of, you guys, Mark as well, but you guys moved me enough that it's hard for me to make jokes about White Claw and do our normal satire. And so I'm just going to quickly say before we end the show that it's clear to me, after reading all your emails and talking through this episode and thinking about the value that hunting brings to my life and always has, that there's so much more at play with what we do outside. There's so much more for us to find value in. And so that's why a podcast like this one and all the other podcasts on our network are endless, because there's so much more for us to explore. So I'm glad we got to hear a couple stories from listeners about how they see holidays and they see hunting and they see all the things that have to do with their families and the connection. So I'm happy for it. We're going to keep going. I feel inspired by you guys. Hope you feel inspired by us. We will see you next week on The Hunting Collective. Say bye, Phil.
Goodbye. Too long, 'cause I can't go a week without doing wrong. Without doing wrong.